Good evening. I wonder if I could just make the obvious request at the very beginning to please all turn off your cell phones. Thank you very much. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Professor Michael Cox. I'm in the Department of International Relations here at the LSE. Welcome. Universities are sometimes referred to by critics, often, and admirers, sometimes, as being ivory towers, implying, of course, they stand hors de combat, that they take no part in public debate. Well, one of the things the LSE takes very great pride in is the fact that it is most definitely not an ivory tower. That we do engage, that we do get our hands dirty, so to speak. We do this in many ways, one of them being our wonderful public lecture series organised by the events here at LSE. I may be a patriot on this particular question, but there is none better. We are pleased to say that we invite the best and the brightest, and more often than not, they accept. And we're certainly delighted that Professor Nancy Kassop, our speaker, has accepted our invitation and agreed to deliver this very special lecture tonight, the Clifford Barclay Memorial Lecture. Professor Nancy Kassop is a distinguished American academic with a formidable track record, educated at Pennsylvania and New York University. Professor Kassop is currently Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the State University of New York at New Paltz. A specialist on the separation of powers and the American presidency, in 2000 she told me that she provided expert advice on presidential transitions to both the Al Gore and George W. Bush teams. Must have been an interesting experience. Nancy Kassop does what few in this country are ever required to do, namely examine the complex relationship between law on the one hand and politics on the other. She has written on this at length, and tonight will speak on the same in her lecture on the Bush administration's controversial and much debated anti-terrorism policies. This is a debate, of course, we are currently in the throes of having in this country, so hopefully Professor Kassop will be able to provide us with some guidance as we engage in our own deliberation. Nancy, welcome once again to the LSE. We all look forward to hearing what you have to say in this, the 13th Clifford Memorial Lecture on Law versus Presidential Power in the Bush Administration's Anti-Terrorism Policies, One at the Expense of the Other. Professor Kassop, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Cox, for that introduction, and it is an honor to be invited to give the Clifford Barclay Memorial Lecture at the LSE this year. I knew Clifford Barclay, and I'm sure he would be quite pleased to know that a robust exchange of views is being conducted in his name tonight. I'm delighted to be with you to talk about the presidency. Thank goodness it's not about the vice presidency. It is either a consequence of great planning or someone's idea of irony that our discussion tonight of presidential power happens to fall on the day that the United States celebrates as President's Day. That celebration began historically as two separate holidays, one devoted to Lincoln's birthday on February 12th and the other to George Washington's birthday on February 22nd. But somewhere along the way, the two merged into one and the references to Lincoln and Washington were abandoned. Well, on this President's Day, 2006, I would say that much more than recognition of Lincoln and Washington has also been cast aside when it comes to assessing the current state of the American presidency. Rather, what has been jettisoned is the carefully calibrated structure of government that James Madison designed in 1787. Government power, according to Madison in the Federalist Number 51, was to be limited and checked through a system of overlapping and shared authority. Each branch would monitor and watch over the other two, to ensure that no branch overstepped its bounds. Power existed in a finite equation. The more claimed by one branch, the less there was for the other two. That risk of losing power to a co-equal branch was reason enough for each one to jealously guard its own authority while keeping the other two honest and accountable. If Madison were alive today, he would be astonished and dismayed at the size, structure, and powers of the modern presidency. But he would mostly fault Congress and the courts for their lack of institutional responsibility and vigilance in performing their checking and balancing role, and thus for allowing presidential power to expand precipitously. So this is really a tale of three branches: a grab for power by the executive, and dereliction of duty by Congress and the courts. More bluntly, this is a story of executive aggrandizement, legislative acquiescence, and judicial abdication. The title of tonight's talk, Law versus Presidential Power in the Bush Administration's Anti-Terrorism Policies, One at the Expense of the Other, was chosen months ago as a catch-all that I assumed would probably describe any number of actions by the Bush administration. I had no idea at that point that a controversy would erupt a couple of months later over the use of the National Security Agency for warrantless domestic surveillance in the United States. I just figured that there were more than enough examples already to illustrate how the Bush administration had used power to obliterate and steamroll over law. The title was a very deliberate and intentional one because it expressed succinctly what I saw as the governing strategy of the Bush administration. The domestic surveillance controversy then represents only the latest example, although perhaps the most damaging one, of an approach that treats the law as inconvenient when power is on your side. So what I would like to do tonight is to address this issue of law versus power with you and give you my impressions of how this simple dichotomy is a consequential shorthand for the Bush administration's strategy for fighting terrorism. And in fact, it's a pretty simple strategy. It can be summed up in what could be a sub-subtitle of this talk, and that would be governing without Congress or the courts, or the hypnotic effect of the words commander-in-chief. On a variety of fronts, the administration's position is that the president has exclusive and absolute power in times of war, and that neither Congress nor the courts can interfere with or restrict that power. It did not have to be this way, and it has never been so in the past. One note that I should insert here, and that is that it might be easy to dismiss what I'm going to say tonight as a red meat anti-Bush speech. But in fact, the motivation behind my remarks is a lot more serious and more substantive than that. I study the presidency, and within that field, I study presidential power. And within that field, I study the constitutional aspects of presidential power. My fellow colleagues and I have watched the Bush presidency for 5 years now, and I would venture to say that there is universal acknowledgement among us that this administration's interpretation of the scope of presidential powers is the most extreme position on executive authority that has ever been articulated, and it has never been accepted by the courts as legitimate or constitutional. What I propose to do tonight is the following. One, provide some examples of how the president has ignored or bypassed Congress, except when Congress gives him what he wants. Two, provide some examples of how the president has written off the courts as having any role to play here, although increasingly the courts are rejecting that position and are starting to reclaim a role for themselves, and when they do act, they are not giving the president what he wants. Three, show you why this marginalizing of Congress and the courts has been a mission of this administration from the start. And four, identify a few key architects of this administration's position or mission. In other words, link people to policies. Consequently, what I hope to demonstrate is that there is a seamless meshing in this administration of political mission, constitutional interpretation, and operative behavior. In short, they are succeeding in implementing the vision they had from the start, and it is a vision that does substantial damage to the office of the presidency and the principle of institutional balance, which we in the United States have always assumed would protect us from tyranny. So let's start with some examples of bypassing Congress. The examples here are ones that come easily to mind: indefinite detention of uncharged foreign national enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, presidential creation of military tribunals for those enemy combatants that he so designates to be tried under procedures he so determines, executive branch definition of which interrogation techniques constitute torture, and presidential decision to decline to use the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as FISA, as a method for authorizing warrantless wiretapping for communications of or with suspected al-Qaeda members. Let's consider some of the patterns that have emerged here. The first two examples, indefinite detention and military tribunals, grow out of an executive order issued by President Bush on November 13, 2001, entitled The Detention, Treatment, and Trial of Certain Non-Citizens in the War Against Terrorism. That executive order laid out the president's policies he intended to use in pursuing and treating terrorist suspects who were not United States citizens. Although it did not specify the use of Guantanamo Bay as a holding place for terrorist suspects, the decision to use Guantanamo was itself indicative of the administration's strategy to find a location for wide-scale and long-term detention that would be beyond U.S. legal jurisdiction. In fact, this tactic backfired, as the Supreme Court determined in a June 2004 decision, Rasul versus Bush, that detainees housed at Guantanamo are, in fact, entitled to bring cases in federal district court to challenge the grounds for their detention. The simple point to make here is that rather than authorize by executive order what were obviously going to be highly provocative and controversial policies, it would have been far more politically expedient and on sounder constitutional footing if President Bush had gone to Congress to ask it to establish these policies by legislation. Historical precedent would have been on his side, since Franklin Roosevelt during World War II asked Congress for similar powers and got all that he asked for, perhaps not Roosevelt's finest hour, as it included the relocation and internment of Japanese Americans, but the larger point here is that FDR understood that these were Congress's policy choices to make and not his alone. The ultimate conclusion here: both of these policies, indefinite detention and military tribunals, are under constitutional challenge currently in the federal courts, with cases due to be heard in the United States Supreme Court in late March. The executive order that authorized them is at the heart of the administration's anti-terror policies, and when it is finally tested in court, I think it will be found constitutionally vulnerable. The other two examples, executive branch definition of torture and presidential refusal to use the FISA law and instead to create a separate and legally questionable system of domestic wiretapping, share the same quality of President Bush's declining either to use existing laws or to modify them by legislative amendments, and rather to take matters into his own hands and assert that he has unilateral authority to decide not to use existing law and to substitute instead his own version of law to authorize these actions. The ultimate conclusion here: on torture, the embarrassing public release of internal executive branch memos 2 years ago put the administration on the defensive, prompted it to scale back its torture definition, and move Congress to reassert and clarify its statutory definition of torture. On the NSA wiretapping, 3 separate actions on this issue were announced just last Thursday. One committee in the House of Representatives announced that it will conduct hearings into the legal justification of the program, while a Senate committee pulled back its initial plan to examine the policy when the White House agreed to work with the committee to craft legislation and to provide program briefings to a larger number of members of Congress. Perhaps even more damaging to the administration's position is a lower federal court decision, again last Thursday, that ordered the Justice Department to turn over its internal memos and opinions on the spying program to 3 watchdog groups. The request was made when reports surfaced that there was internal disagreement within the Justice Department on the constitutionality of the program, and that the president went ahead with it anyway, despite opposition from key legal advisors in that department, including then Attorney General John Ashcroft. So on all 4 of these issues, the White House is paying a price for its unilateral action. One broader consequence here is that when the president overreaches, he may end up jeopardizing the very security he claims is the most important responsibility of a president to protect. In this vein, some of the enemy combatant cases are starting to bring additional claims, either that the use of torture or the gathering of evidence against these defendants by illegal wiretapping under the NSA program fatally taints the government's cases here and should result in their dismissal. Wiser heads would and should have counseled the president that policy overreach can come back and bite you. If these combatants really are the, quote, very bad guys that our leaders say they are, then it would make more sense for those leaders to be sure that the policies they devise to go after these men are ones that will pass legal muster and not backfire by resulting in the release of the very people we have branded as evil and dangerous. Let's turn to the courts and examine the president's assertion that the courts have no role to play in judging wartime policies. Here there are repeated statements by Justice Department lawyers in government briefs in 5 cases. They are the Hamdi, Rasul, Padilla, Guantanamo detainee cases, and Hamden. These statements all reiterate explicitly or implicitly that the president will not tolerate interference by the courts in these matters. Here are a few examples. In the Hamdi case, this is of an American citizen captured in Afghanistan in late 2001, fighting with the Taliban, and imprisoned in a military brig in the United States, although not Guantanamo, who petitioned the courts for release under a writ of habeas corpus. The Justice Department argued in its briefs, and I quote, "Courts have an extremely narrow role in reviewing the adequacy of the government's return in a habeas action such as this, challenging the quintessentially military judgment to detain an individual as an enemy combatant in a time of war. A court's inquiry should come to an end once the military has shown that it has determined that the detainee is an enemy combatant," end quote. So the position here is that the courts should defer to the president when he operates under his commander-in-chief authority, and that when the military captures a person on the battlefield, that is both the beginning as well as the end of the inquiry. Moreover, a key element in the Bush administration's legal strategy is that the nature of terrorism has made the whole world a battlefield. The boundaries are infinite. There are no geographical limits to the battlefield in the war on terror. The consequence, then, is that terror suspects can be apprehended anywhere in the world as well as in the United States. The Hamdi case is also the one where, in the Supreme Court's answer to the president's arguments, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor issued her emphatic and much-quoted line that, quote, "We have long since made clear that a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens," end quote. What was equally stirring were the few sentences preceding this one, where she said, and I quote, "We necessarily reject the government's assertion that separation of powers principles mandate a heavily circumscribed role for the courts in such circumstances. Indeed, the position that the courts must forego any examination of the individual case cannot be mandated by any reasonable view of separation of powers, as this approach serves only to condense power into a single branch of government. Whatever power the United States Constitution envisions for the executive in its exchanges with other nations or with enemy organizations in times of conflict, it most assuredly envisions a role for all three branches when individual liberties are at stake." Another case known as Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. This is the case of an enemy combatant from Yemen who was captured in Afghanistan in late 2001, who has been described as bin Laden's driver. He was detained at Guantanamo Bay, and he's one of the handful of individuals that President Bush has designated for trial by military commission, in his case, charged with conspiracy to commit various war crimes. Hamdan challenged his detention and enemy combatant designation in a petition for habeas corpus and the government motion to dismiss the suit on the basis that the president had inherent authority as commander-in-chief to designate, detain, and subject to military tribunals non-United States citizen enemy combatants who did not meet the criteria for prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions. The ruling by the district court judge in that case, Judge Robertson, had two parts to it. One, that the military tribunals, as provided in Bush's November 13, 2001 executive order, were unconstitutional because their procedures were contrary or inconsistent with the procedures required in court-martials. This part of the case has been appealed and will be heard in the U.S. Supreme Court on March 28th. But two, the second part of his ruling was equally significant and provided a compelling metaphor for this larger issue of the president substituting his power for law and of the president pushing aside judicial bodies. Robertson noted that the Geneva Conventions required that combatants captured on the battlefield are presumed to be prisoners of war unless and until a, quote, competent tribunal determines that they are not. Well, in 2002, President Bush, on the advice of Justice Department lawyers, and over the objections of State Department lawyers and officials, including then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, determined on his authority as Commander-in-Chief that he alone could make a blanket ruling that all al-Qaeda members automatically did not meet the requirements for prisoner-of-war status. If they had been permitted prisoner-of-war designation, they would have been entitled to being formally charged with war crimes and being tried by a court-martial, which would have included far greater procedural protections than in the military tribunal, whose procedures and rules are whatever the military or executive branch decides they should be. Thus, Robertson rejected Bush's blanket ruling here on the non-applicability of Geneva to al-Qaeda, and further ruled that since no competent tribunal has as yet determined whether Hamdan was or was not a prisoner of war, he was at the very least entitled to the judgment of such a tribunal, and Robertson said, quote, "The president is not a tribunal and could not make the judgment that only a court could make." So thus far, we can sum up the legal foundation for the Bush administration's actions across a number of cases as some combination of the following two documents and one constitutional claim. The two documents are the September 18, 2001 authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan and the November 13, 2001 executive order, and also a constitutional claim of inherent executive authority based on the fact that the president is commander-in-chief. Let's take a closer look at the use of force authorization and the constitutional claim. The administration maintains that the authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan, sometimes known as the AUMF, the resolution that Congress passed within a week after September 11, 2001, provides expressed or implied power for a president to use, and I quote, all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks or harbored such organizations or persons. The argument is extended even further by the administration that since Congress authorized the president to engage in military hostilities, that authorization logically permits a president to also take actions short of war, thus including detention, enemy combatant designation, and warrantless domestic wiretapping, anything necessary to fight terrorism. The greater power, it was argued, necessarily embraced the lesser. But the opposing argument here is that the authorization to use military force is just that, and nothing other than an authorization to use military force, and that authority to detain prisoners indefinitely and without rights, or to order warrantless wiretapping, needed to be enacted with specificity. That argument was then countered by government attorneys with the second prong supporting the president's power to act in wartime. And this is that the president's power as commander-in-chief provides any and all authority he needs to do anything he thinks will further national security. Commander-in-chief authority, they argue, is broad enough and limitless enough to meet any necessity. As such, then, it negated any need for further specificity or further authorization from Congress to take specific acts. It was, as Lyndon Johnson might have described it, in the way that he described a comparable authorization to use military force in his own administration, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, like grandma's nightshirt. It's big enough to cover everything. If both of these arguments, authorization to use military force and commander-in-chief authority, have a familiar and current ring to them, it is because they are the same ones used by the administration to justify the National Security Agency domestic surveillance program. Let's take a closer look at this commander-in-chief authority and see how other presidents have used it and how courts have interpreted its scope. If you read the words of Article 2 in the U.S. Constitution carefully, you will note that they say, and I quote, the president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States, end quote. That provision gives the president a title, commander-in-chief, but no specific list of powers that he can exercise in that capacity. It also suggests that the president is not commander-in-chief all of the time, but only, quote, when called into the actual service of the United States. As Alexander Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Paper number 69, the president will have only the occasional command of such part of the militia of the nation as by legislative provision may be called into the actual service of the nation, end quote. It is Congress, then, that calls the president into service as commander-in-chief when it declares war or authorizes the use of force by statute. The framers of the U.S. Constitution could not have been clearer. The decision to go to war belongs to the deliberative branch of government, Congress, because declaring war is a political and legislative decision to move the nation from a state of peace to a state of war. Only then does the president command the troops and conduct military operations. Hamilton also described the president's commander-in-chief power as, quote, amounting to nothing more than the supreme command of the military and naval forces as first general and admiral of the Confederacy, end quote. But as a law professor, Louis Henkin, has noted, quote, generals and admirals, even when they are first, do not determine the political purposes for which troops are to be used. They command them in the execution of policy made by others. Thus, there is a clear division of authority between the institution charged with making the political decision to go to war and the institution charged with commanding the troops once war is underway. It is undoubtedly true, however, that this is a sterile, purist view of the Constitution and that war making today no longer works this way in practice and has not functioned in this manner for quite some time. This change in the office came not from FDR, the president and wartime leader to whom the origin of the modern presidency is most often attributed, but rather from Harry Truman. Although Roosevelt acted at times on his own authority, he never claimed that the Commander-in-Chief Clause gave him unilateral or inherent authority to use military force, and he never asserted that there was no need to go to Congress because his role as Commander-in-Chief gave him all the authority he needed. Instead, historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has noted that Roosevelt conducted extensive and vigilant consultation within the executive branch, between the executive and legislative branches, among leaders of both parties, and with the press before taking some of his most controversial actions. In an earlier war, Abraham Lincoln came closer to what is sometimes called a constitutional dictatorship than any other American president. But even though he acted independently at the onset of the Civil War while Congress was in recess by calling forth the militia, suspending the writ of habeas corpus, and ordering a blockade of southern ports, Lincoln brought his actions to Congress immediately afterwards to ask for its authority retroactively. He understood that he was using Congress's authority and not his own. Congress, for its part, passed legislation that approved and legalized all of the acts that Lincoln had taken at the start of the war. Similar to Roosevelt, then, Lincoln also never claimed that he possessed sole power to act. He acknowledged openly that he had acted beyond the constitutional powers of the presidency and that he needed Congress's approval to ratify his actions. Thus, although he may have acted under powers of both the president and Congress, he did not act outside of the Constitution, and he subjected his actions to the will of Congress at the first available moment. It is Harry Truman, though, who bears the distinction for being the first president to make such sweeping claims when he sent U.S. forces to Korea in 1950 without congressional authorization, and then defended his related decision to use that power domestically to seize private steel mills in 1952, based on his inherent authority as commander-in-chief during wartime. That claim opened the door for future presidents to assert that the decision to use military force rested in the White House alone. What a distance we have traveled since Hamilton and Madison, who would not recognize and certainly would not dignify such a claim as consistent with the Constitution. Truman's actions established a precedent for presidents to ignore and bypass what had previously been understood and honored as baseline constitutional requirements. Thus, the shift in constitutional approach from Lincoln and Roosevelt on the one hand to Truman on the other was significant, if not tectonic. Most importantly, it signaled a new interpretation of the Commander-in-Chief Clause as a source of executive war-making authority independent of Congress. But Truman's new paradigm did not survive judicial scrutiny when he turned his Commander-in-Chief power inward and claimed inherent power domestically to seize a private industry in order to continue steel production to support the war effort. This is the famous and recently rediscovered Supreme Court case of Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company versus Sawyer, sometimes known as the Steel Seizure Case of 1952, that was the subject of intense debate in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the confirmation of the newest Supreme Court Justice, Samuel Alito, as well as at the recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the National Security Agency's domestic surveillance program. It was no surprise to many constitutional scholars that Youngstown has figured so prominently in contemporary discussions of the Bush administration's wartime policies. It is the quintessential Supreme Court case on inherent presidential power. What is surprising, though, is how the administration has managed to make lemonade out of lemons. By that, I mean that the court's decision in Youngstown technically determined that a president did not have inherent authority and could not, as commander-in-chief, act in violation of a law of Congress or contrary to the express or implied intent of Congress. And yet the Bush administration makes these very claims that a president does have inherent authority and that he may act contrary to a law or the intent of Congress when the national security requires it. There is no starker expression of this position than a memo written by a Justice Department lawyer, John Yoo, in the Office of Legal Counsel, 2 weeks after September 11th, which among its many controversial and extreme positions, the most striking were that the president's inherent authority permitted him to deploy military force preemptively, and that Congress could not place any limits on the president's determinations as to any terrorist threat, the amount of military force to be used in response, or the method, timing, and nature of the response. Grandma's nightshirt, indeed. Let's try to pull some of these strands together. If the Bush administration's strategy is that Congress and the courts have a minimal role, if any, to play in the anti-terrorism policies, then with what are we left? Executive branch exclusivity, the view that the executive branch is the only one to be trusted because protecting national security is too critical to leave to the other branches. But that's a practical argument, not a constitutional one. And it is one that the framers of the Constitution anticipated and rejected in the same way that the courts have rejected it. The framers fully understood that the Constitution they created would operate in war as well as in peace, and they provided ways to trigger emergency powers when the government needs and requests them. Congress may suspend the writ of habeas corpus in times of rebellion or invasion, and Congress can authorize the use of emergency powers when circumstances warrant that. What a president may not do is to order his own emergency powers contrary to existing laws. So as in the case of the FISA law, at least initially after September 11th, the president asked Congress to amend the law when it passed the Patriot Act to provide better intelligence gathering ability, and Congress responded by giving the president and intelligence agencies all of the enhanced capabilities they requested. Congress has responded 8 times with amendments to the FISA law, so the president has gotten everything he has asked. But the president never asked Congress to authorize domestic warrantless wiretapping, but went ahead and did it anyway. The president did not get what he asked for at the time of the passage of the September 18th authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan. As recounted in a recent New York Times op-ed piece by then-majority leader of the Senate, Tom Daschle, he writes, and I quote, "On the evening of September 12, 2001, the White House proposed that Congress authorize the use of military force to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States. Believing the scope of this language was too broad and ill-defined, Congress chose instead on September 14th to authorize, quote, all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons the president determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the attacks of September 11th. With this language, Congress denied the president the more expansive authority he sought and insisted that his authority be used specifically against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Just before the Senate acted on this compromise resolution, the White House sought one last change in wording. Literally minutes before the Senate cast its vote, the administration sought to add the words, in the United States and after appropriate force in the agreed upon text. So the proposed wording from the White House would have then read as giving the president all necessary and appropriate force in the United States and against those nations, organizations, persons the president determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th. According to Senator Daschle, quote, this last-minute change would have given the president broad authority to exercise expansive powers, not just overseas, where we all understood he wanted authority to act, but right here in the United States, potentially against American citizens. I could see no justification for Congress to accede to this extraordinary request for additional authority. I refused. The facts of this exchange between a president and Congress are virtually parallel to the facts in the Youngstown case with President Truman that I mentioned just a short while ago. There, Congress had considered giving Truman authority to seize domestic industries in times of emergencies, but Congress rejected that proposal, and Truman seized them anyway. The basis for the Supreme Court's decision in 1952 was that the president could not do what Congress had not authorized him to do, and even more precisely, could not do what Congress had considered and denied him the authority to do. The president's authority, the court said, was to enforce the laws that Congress made, not to make his own laws. There should be a lesson there for the present administration. I wonder who will tell them. And to the final part of this picture, what drives such a strategy of executive branch exclusivity? What and who? The answers are quite simple and clear. It is an exceptionally well-defined and calculated effort to centralize power in the White House and thus to draw it away from the other two branches and even from other parts of the executive branch that are not reliable partners in supporting White House policies. The strategy of centralization began with the Nixon White House, continued through the Reagan years, and lest you think this is a partisan critique, you can be assured that it was practiced in the Clinton White House as well. The acknowledged and unabashed architect of that strategy is Vice President Cheney, who never fails to repeat his mantra that, quote, we want to leave the office of the presidency stronger than we found it, end quote. Cheney is unashamed to state on the record that he thinks that recent presidents, including the Republicans' beloved Ronald Reagan, squandered presidential power and let it slip from their hands, and that it is the mission of the present administration to repair the damage and to restore the lost powers of the office. A typical Cheney quote is the following. I have repeatedly seen an erosion of the powers and the ability of the President of the United States to do his job. The presidency is weaker today as an institution because of the unwise compromises that have been made over the last 30 to 35 years, end quote. One plausible explanation for this is that Cheney witnessed firsthand, when he was Gerald Ford's chief of staff after Nixon's resignation, the restraints imposed on the presidency by a Congress and the courts who wanted to shrink an imperial presidency that had gotten out of control under Nixon. Throughout the mid-1970s, there was a remarkable spate of legislation that reasserted congressional power and that imposed strict oversight over the president, requiring him to report to Congress frequently so it could keep a watchful eye on him. Some of those laws are the War Powers Act of 1973, the Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974, the National Emergencies Act of 1976, the Hughes-Ryan Act of 74, the Ethics in Government Act of 1978, the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1976, Congress was busy, and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. The common denominator for all of these laws is that each one has failed to achieve its objective of reforming the system. And one of the reasons for that is that most presidents serving under these restrictions since the 1970s resented being restrained under law and tried to find ways to operate around them. Sound familiar? Cheney is now in a position to react, and with a vengeance, to that congressional reassertion, a reaction that has been building for decades under both Republican and Democratic presidents alike. It has manifested itself in what I call the arrogant presidency and is a successor to the imperial presidency. And Cheney has a skillful associate to help him pull off this task, his former counsel to the Office of the Presidency, David Addington, who only recently was moved upstairs to replace Scooter Libby as Cheney's chief of staff when Libby resigned after being indicted. Addington is a 48-year-old lawyer who has worked as a counsel to the Defense Department, to the CIA, and to the House Foreign Affairs and Intelligence Committees during the Iran-Contra inquiry of the 1980s, an experience that many who know him shaped his iron will to never again allow Congress to tie the president's hands. He was the chief author of the Bush administration's controversial detention, interrogation, and surveillance policies, and bears the description by his Republican friends as, quote, Cheney's gatekeeper, the ideological enforcer, and the hardest of the hardcore. One reporter quipped, "Where there has been controversy over the past 5 years, there has often been Addington." Addington is a staunch proponent of the theory of the unitary executive, a theory that posits the president's complete authority in wartime and that views as illegitimate and unenforceable any statute that infringes on the president's authority. If his is not a household name to you, don't worry, you're not alone. And that only means that his determined efforts to fly under the radar screen and to stay in the shadows has succeeded. He is legendary around Washington for declining to be interviewed or photographed by the media. One final point deserves to be mentioned here, and that is that to pursue this strategy of centralization of power in the White House, the Bush administration has used an exceptionally clever tactic, but one that has risks of backfiring. Not only did they pull power into the White House staff and away from executive branch departments and cabinet secretaries, but the truly innovative part was to take people who had served on the White House staff in the first term and place them in cabinet positions in the second term. I'm referring here to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Especially in Gonzalez's case, this tactic carries inherent risks in that he is now in a position as Attorney General where the policy he helped to fashion as counsel to the president in the first term are being challenged in the courts in the second term. And now as Attorney General, he's likely to be called upon to defend them or to investigate them. Thus, in his job as the chief law enforcement official of the country, he brings with him an intimate knowledge of the policies he may be asked to investigate. It will be difficult to deliver impartial justice under those circumstances. Finally, the scorecard for separation of powers and checks and balances in the current context seems to be that in the 5 years since September 11th, Congress has been mostly asleep at the wheel, either delegating overly broad and unclear power to the president or none at all, while the president still simply filled in the vacuum either by executive order or by excessive claims of constitutional authority, exhibiting no sense of hesitation that he perhaps might need the participation of Congress to assure the constitutionality of his actions. Congress is starting to wake up in small incremental steps to the realization that it has an institutional role to play. But only when members of the president's own party start to speak out and take independent stands will public opinion demand accountability by and from the system. The courts have been the venue for the deeper inquiries on these policies, and the Bush administration has done all it could to derail these efforts. The Supreme Court addressed a trio of important cases in June 2004, and its decisions resulted mostly in sharp rebukes to the president. The court, then, is starting to apprehend the enormity of the exclusive powers the president has claimed. Now we have Terrorism II cases, the second round, as well as two new Supreme Court justices. By late June of this year, we may have more answers from the court, especially on the constitutionality of military tribunals and indefinite detention, and on the president's authority to provide for these by executive order alone. In conclusion, presidents have grabbed Congress's war power for themselves, Congress has not been effective in reclaiming its lost power, and the courts have only started to engage in this constitutional dialogue. The actions of this president have eroded the cornerstones of the Constitution and the system of a government of limited powers that it established. And yes, President Bush's strategy would stun Madison and Hamilton by the certitude with which he proclaims the singularity of his office and its powers. They would not be pleased by this current state of the presidency, and neither should we be. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. We have some time, obviously, for questions and answers and short contributions from the floor. So could I see hands rising around me? There's a gentleman over in the far corner there. I'll take him first. Sir, yes, and then there's a gentleman here. Please.
Yeah, does this speaker agree with someone like Lyndon LaRouche that what you've got in the U.S., as he says, a spade is a spade? You've not used the word fascism and Nazism. Do you agree with his analysis? And secondly, what about the notion of a coup d'etat given the election rigging that has been alleged? What's your comments on that? Thank you.
I'm probably one of the very few people in this audience who knows who Lyndon LaRouche is, so I won't go into that. So Nancy, why don't you pick that one up anyway?
Well, okay.
Are you going fascist?
Not that I know of.
No,
I would begin by answering the first part of your question to say I'm an institutionalist. I'm actually very moderate in my views, and so no, I would not agree with Lyndon LaRouche. I believe that the institutions of government should function as they were set up to do so back in 1787. So I do very much believe in the system. I just think that the system needs to, at this point, take stock, and that there has been an imbalance in the system. One branch has taken more power than it deserves, and the other two have to do their job and push back. On your second question about a coup d'etat, I knew I was going to get this question. The question is, you know, is Bush ripe for impeachment? And the answer to that, despite the fact that my own member of Congress is the first one calling for impeachment, is that, first of all, you don't impeach a president when both houses of Congress are in his own party. So the first step is the congressional elections of upcoming in November 2006, and even though there is a chance that the Democrats could take either one or both houses, that still doesn't augur well for an impeachment of President Bush. And the reason why, I will tell you, going back again to the Iran-Contra inquiry of the late 1980s, it was in the last 2 years of President Reagan's administration, the difference only being that Reagan had a high level of personal popularity, and I don't know that in the last 2 years of his administration, although it's still to be had, whether Bush would suffer, whether Bush would maintain that same popularity. However, the Democrats in 1987 made a calculated choice not to go after an impeachment inquiry for over the Iran-Contra affair with President Reagan. And in some respects, they made a wise choice, and I guess my fear is that the Democrats, should they take both houses of Congress in 2006, might not be so wise and they might overreach. Democrats have a real tendency to overreach, and when they overreach, they tend to undermine their credibility. So I guess it's a long answer to your question of no, I don't see a coup d'etat happening. I do see an extreme weakening in President Bush's personal popularity. I think that will translate into perhaps Democratic victories in the congressional elections, since an off-year election is always a referendum on the ability of the president. So I think that's sort of the best we can hope for. I would probably caution against impeachment, even though I certainly don't agree with the policies of the Bush administration.
Okay, it's official. No fascism, no coup d'etat.
Sorry.
That's okay. Gentleman here. Yeah, thanks. I can pick up other hands, too.
Thanks for coming. Two questions. What are the legal constraints on signing an executive order? Like, what are the legal constraints on signing an executive order? And how have presidents looked at public opinion in the past when signing executive orders? Thanks.
Okay. When you ask what are the legal constraints, are you asking what is it that the president has to consider in signing it, and who is there to stop him from doing so? Okay. Actually, that's a very good question, and I probably should have given a bit more of an explanation of what an executive order is. An executive order is an issuing of a policy by the president that binds the federal, it binds the executive branch. So it binds the executive branch in their carrying out of the law. It's often referred to as what the president can do with the stroke of a pen. The other way of looking at it, however, is it is binding law. It has the same legal effect as an act of Congress. But an act of Congress is acting directly on the people, whereas an executive order acts on government. So it binds the government. What restrictions are there on a president? It's not so much that there are restrictions. Executive orders traditionally have usually been a further carrying out of laws enacted by Congress. It's usually to carry out in a more specific or precise way what Congress has already enacted. Presidents, however, can issue executive orders separate from acts of Congress, but they must not contradict an act of Congress. And any president can rescind an executive order that his predecessor had issued, and an executive order can be overturned by an act of Congress. So in other words, if an act of Congress is passed that's contrary to what the president has ordered, the later of the two then rules, that the congressional act then rules out the executive order. Does that answer your question? Okay, and the second part was? If they don't consider it, it's at their peril. But frankly, an executive order is a way for a president to enact into law something that he may believe is not possible to get enacted by Congress. So in other words, he can use it in a way that sidesteps Congress, but perhaps he might do so at his peril if, in fact, public popularity is not with him.
Okay, young chap here. I'm discriminating in favor of all my students at the moment. They're the only hands going up. There's a gentleman at the front as well. Thanks. It is not discrimination. Eugene.
Thank you. I have a question about the international implications of what you were speaking about today. In accounting for the success and persistence of the U.S.-led world order, John Eikenberry of Princeton, as you may well know, argues that American power has been, the exercise of American power has been very predictable during the last 50 years. My question is, what are the implications of the trends that you've discussed today on the perceived predictability of the exercise of American power? And perhaps more interestingly, for the democratic peace theory.
My goodness. You don't have to answer the second part.
I'm not an IR specialist. I mean,
I'll
know of
the difference. You answered the first
okay,
one. How's that?
Okay, I guess I would step back by saying it seems to me that some of the questions you're asking refer to the world perception of the American of America's power as a foreign policy power. In fact, what I was really referring to was primarily policies that were turned inward. In other words, when the president uses his authority that he gets from being commander-in-chief or military chief and uses those to turn towards domestic policies or policies that are related to the military efforts, such as Guantanamo. So the quick answer in terms of what does that do to America's prestige and reputation is it has clearly taken a major dive, and I think deservedly so. But the point is, I think both domestically as well as internationally, there has been this very strong sense of unease about the kind of positions that the president has taken. And partly what I think I was trying to convey is that this is a position that he and those closest advisors around him have taken. And it has not been necessarily supported by either the American people or certainly by Congress. He hasn't gone to Congress to ask for that support, whether there are reasons, good reasons for that or not. So in fact, it's a solitary policy that he and those around him, and he is in some ways quite insulated. So once again, I would say he does this at his peril. And over to you.
No, I'll leave that. Could I just follow up as a quick supplementary to follow up on that? So what? This administration has not really been terribly bothered by international opinion on a whole issue. whole range of issues. Kyoto, global warming, mm-hmm. International Criminal Court, mm-hmm. the landmine. I mean, you know, name it and add it to the list. So, in a sense, there is a kind of an underlying philosophy of this administration not to worry about international public opinion. Voters in Ohio, maybe, but not international public opinion.
Okay. One of the reasons why I describe it as arrogant, that there isn't any concern for that. Another reason would be the fact that, as I suggested, that Vice President Cheney is the driving force, and that his mission is to strengthen the powers of the presidency. And thirdly, I suppose I would say, and you know, your question of so what is a good one, what are they gaining in the end? If this president is concerned about the L word, as the previous president was, that means his legacy, that's where he may well pay a price. He may accomplish what he wants to while he's in office, but he also might pay a price for his legacy.
Okay, right. There's a gentleman at the front here, please. If you could just... Here we go. There we go. Sir.
You seem to indicate that the court, Supreme Court, might put some constraints on Bush in their next series of decisions. With the change from Sandra Day O'Connor to Alito, how likely is that?
Alito and Roberts. It's a very good question.
Roberts is replacing a conservative, so right. It's not a rebalance, but Alito is a rebalance.
Sure. A lot of it depends on Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is considered the swing vote right now. Those justices who are likely to support a stronger view of civil liberties and perhaps an anti-presidency view would be Ginsburg, Souter, Stevens, and Breyer. And so those are four votes. The Supreme Court has 9 members. You need 5 in order to get a majority on a case. So therefore, Justice Anthony Kennedy is really the determining factor. So in some respects, you can almost discount Alito and or Roberts on the other side if Kennedy goes with the other 4. And that's the big question. And everybody has said Kennedy is now the future of the Supreme Court. He holds more power than any other single justice. And I can't make a prediction.
Okay, fine. I hope that's an answer. There's a gentleman over here looking very pensive.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Well, this is a follow-up of what Professor Cox has just said. The BBC gave very unpleasant news to the Americans. They found the ratings just 2-3 days ago that while worldwide Japan was at the top, the United States was at the bottom. This has been going on and on and on by American, British, Arab, and so on. Doesn't it worry you as an American citizen? You were talking about constitutional powers, law, and so on. Doesn't it worry you as an American citizen, as an American nation, as a leader of the civilized world, that your country is at the bottom of worldwide public opinion?
Of course it bothers me. How could it not bother me? It bothers me as a citizen, but it also bothers me professionally because I see the institution that I revere and that I, the institutions of government that I revere being undermined. And so I see the reason for that low level of popularity because of what I call the arrogance of power of this administration. And yes, I'm terribly troubled by it.
What can be done to reverse it?
That's exactly
what I knew that. I could tell.
Yeah. Have the countervailing institutions of Congress and the court begin to tell the president, you can't do these things. And the only way Congress is going to do that is if it gets a change in the majority party. There are a few Republicans that are beginning to speak out, a few members of the president's own party who have come out against his policies, but they're very, sort of brave souls in the wind. I think a lot of Americans are looking forward to those 2006 congressional elections and the unpredictability at this point of what might happen in the Supreme Court. Just as the Truman case that I mentioned in 1952 was a severe rebuke to that president of his policies, and if a comparable decision by the court in these cases coming forward might, one would think, put the president down a notch.
We shall wait and see. Right, gentleman here. And then the gentleman in front. Yeah. Sir.
I presume that the president has all these powers because the United States is at war. At war with whom, and how do you define war?
Well, that was one of the reasons I tried to explain a bit about the commander-in-chief authority, which is what the president says, that you know, when we are at war, I can be commander-in-chief and I can do anything I want. One of the interesting things about the authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan, the 2001 authorization, well, I guess I should step back and say, yes, we are at war, but we're at two wars. And those are two distinct wars. One is the war against terrorism, for which the 2001 congressional authorization allowed the president to take actions. And of course, the second war is the war in Iraq, which had its own separate authorization from Congress in the fall of 2002. So the administration sees those two as being meshed. I'm not sure they always are. So I'm not sure which war you're referring to.
Which war is America engaged in? You said it's the terrorists,
mm-hmm.
but war wasn't usually defined like that, was it? War was between countries.
Exactly.
And America is not truly at war with Iraq now, right?
Well, I guess I would disagree with that. I would say we are. I mean, then you get into the quibble between what's the difference between a declaration of war and an authorization to use military force. But the authorization to use military force, at least militarily, has the same legal implications as a declaration of war. Declaration of war has more international legal implications that are not present with the authorization. However, the war against terrorism that you referred to before, one of the difficult things of trying to discern that is that because it is so amorphous, it's, you know, who's the enemy? The enemy is these people, it's these organizations, it's these groups, it's those who harbor and protect them. It's not a traditional state. So state-to-state type of conflict is not what we're talking about here. Consequently, it is more ambiguous, more, as I said, amorphous, it's seamy, and it's also, of course, open-ended. There's no time limit. In the past, most congressional authorizations to use military force had a defined target or a defined adversary and gave some idea of what the scope of that that conflict would be. Here, as I said, the scope of the conflict is infinite, both geographically as well as temporally. And so, of course, the administration uses that to their benefit by saying that because this is a new kind of enemy, it's a new kind of war, it therefore requires new kinds of tools to fight it. And that's the argument they're trying to make. And to some extent, they have succeeded.
This gentleman here, at the front.
Could you account for the spinelessness of Congress immediately after 9/11, when Bush managed to get over that if you opposed him, you were unpatriotic? And it just seemed to put all the opposition to the sword, really, which gave him this excessive power that he's taken.
Yeah. And actually, the answer to your question goes very much to the question of domestic politics and the source of where members of Congress get their legitimacy. They get their legitimacy in their home districts. And so, in fact, you know, their primary incentive is to simply run and win elections. And in order to win an election, they could not be seen as being somehow unpatriotic. So in fact, they were more worried about their own jobs, maintaining those jobs, and they were swept up by this fervor, and it was very, very difficult to oppose the president on those authorizations. More than that, I guess I would say, perhaps, and I'm not trying to defend them, but whenever presidents have asked for authorization to use military force, they've always gotten them. And part of that is what's known as the rally around the flag effect, that when the nation has been is at risk, when the nation has been attacked, or when the nation is on the verge of war, there is this mindset that sets in about we need to protect the homeland, we need to do whatever is necessary. And so routinely, historically, presidents have always gotten high levels of support. Of course, the interesting point is what happens later on. I was even present at the Supreme Court in one of the arguments in one of the cases back in 2004, where Justice Souter made a comment to the Justice Department attorney about the fact that that some of these extreme measures, when they were taken immediately after September 11th, might have been understood. They might have been understandable. But that as time goes on, not so much that the emergency lessens, but you begin to find ways to routinize and regularize these procedures as opposed to maintaining emergency-level protections. And that it's now 5 years later, and you would have thought that that there would have been some effort on Congress's part to say, okay, this is a permanent, well, this is the state we're in right now, let's try to find some way to put this into law that is done through the deliberative process. So again, the answer to your question primarily about Congress is that they're watching out for their own jobs.
Is there gonna come a time when they're gonna find their backbones again? You think?
Very, very, tiny steps are being taken right now.
Okay.
And I preface that as tiny.
Right. Sounds familiar. Over there, in yellow.
Hello. It's well documented that power swings in Washington between Congress and the administration and back and forth. And this comes in cycles. Is Bush's bypassing of Congress something that we should be particularly alarmed about, or since he's coming to the end of his administration, should we just wait it out and see how things will come about again?
That's a lot of waiting out to do. There's a lot he can do between now and the end of his term. You are correct that there are cycles, and that's one of the reasons to some extent why we referred back to the Nixon era and the fact that right after, well, as Nixon stepped down when he resigned from office, there was a spate of legislation to try to address the fact of all of the abuses that had occurred during Nixon's presidency. And yet, interestingly enough, all of those reforms have fallen flat on their face. They haven't really done what they intended to do. So is it likely, and the same thing was true after Iran-Contra as well. There was also, at that point, another round of legislation to try to make sure that that type of incident would not happen again. So this time we have a different kind of incident, but it's equally of a president using power in an excessive sort of way. So will there be a congressional backlash to try to put more restraints on future presidents? I imagine there will be. But again, it also depends who's in Congress. It also depends what happens between now, whether or not there are future terrorist attacks, and how devastating and deadly. You know, all of those things are in some ways very much uncertain and unforeseen. But you are correct that there is this normal cycle that happens, and that is true.
I'm just going to use the chair's privilege to at least ask a question, and I'll come back. I hate to ask you this question, Nancy, so that's why I'm going to ask it. What implications do you think this has for the analysis of British politics? When I was listening to you, I didn't know if I was hearing about the United States or our own dear benighted kingdom. Increasing executive authority, a weak executive, a weak legislature. I won't say anything about judges. There may be one or two in the audience. I mean, is this not a more general trend you're looking at here? I mean, what is particularly true for the United States is also becoming true in this country, and I would suspect is also not far away from the truth in Europe and elsewhere. I mean, is it that the war on terrorism is pushing us all in a certain direction, and so therefore what you're saying about the US may be specific for the US, but it seems to me has something more general to be drawn from that, about the basic increasing imbalance between executive and legislature, and particularly towards the executive in a time of anxiety and fear and insecurity, which clearly terrorism has produced.
I think that's probably a valid point, and that people in times of when their liberties, when their homeland and when their security is being threatened, they turn to the government for protection. They want the government to protect them. I guess probably my reaction, however, would be that our system of government, separation of powers, and a Congress that is supposed to check that. In other words, it's certainly possible for Bush to get many of the protections that he wants, as long as he goes through the proper procedures. And so in some respects, that's one of my concerns. I want to protect the country as well as anybody else, but I want it to be done after a process of having Congress think about, deliberate on the issues, and determine that, yes, this is a policy we want, as opposed to being dictated to by one man.
But do you think this has greater international significance other than just for the United States?
I don't know. Does any other nation have the same type of governmental system that we have?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that I may incriminate myself. There was a gentleman who put his hand up, so I will take this as the very last question. Please, sir.
Well, this follows on from your last point. Do you think the American public are aware of these issues, the issues you outline in your talk through the media, or are these simply matters that people are talking about in universities?
That is a good question, and I guess I would say, there is probably a wide swath of the American population that is more concerned about pocketbook issues. They're concerned about the price of gas and the price of home heating oil and whether or not they're going to have their health benefits. It's not until they really see the actual effects of these policies. Are they worried about domestic spying? Probably not. They probably don't think it's something that's going to implicate them. To some extent, it is an elitist group that is more focused on these matters. Certainly, it is clearly the academics and, to some extent, the lawyers that are focused on the legal insufficiencies here. But I think over time, as we see with the president's popularity starting to decline, I think it is beginning to have a corrosive effect on the population. Maybe not in any specific sense, they can't point their finger to anything, but they're beginning to see that maybe he has overstepped his bounds.
Okay, with that I'll call it to an end. If I could just, if this is protocol to do this, I would like to make an announcement on other lectures coming this week, because they are very much germane to what has been discussed here this evening by Nancy. We have three lectures coming up over the next 3 days, in fact, Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, by Professor Alan Kruger, defining and measuring terrorism, obviously related to what we're talking about tonight, microeconometric evidence. This will be the Lionel Robbins Memorial Lecture. I'll be most interested to see what an economist has to say about measuring terrorism. Only an economist could try that one, I think. But anyway, three lectures coming up on I think, a very related topic. Secondly, may I thank the audience. I say all great lectures require an audience. I think I've sometimes given some of my greatest lectures before about three people. And so it's very nice to have an excellent audience and turnout, as not always at the LSE, but clearly indication of the interest in the topic and the quality of the speaker. And finally, thank you, Nancy, for coming here to the LSE, for delivering a brilliant lecture and handling the questions with some very pertinent and direct answers. It makes a change. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.